Hi there, listener, and welcome to the sixth and last in our series of podcasts focusing on the best snow sports equipment for winter 2025. Now, in our first five episodes, we looked at the best skis, the best ski boots, goggles, socks, jackets, helmets, gloves. And you can catch up with all of those episodes wherever you download your podcasts or on the Skipedia YouTube channel if you want to see what Al and I look like. But today, for our last equipment episode for 2025, we're going to look at ski touring. Now, before I go on, I would like to put a shout out for Ellis Brigham. Ellis Brigham sponsored this special episode of the Ski Podcast. It's been made possible by them, and they are the winter sports specialists. They have 16 shops around the UK where you can find all the kit that you need for this winter. Alternatively, simply go to their website, ellis-brigham.com, and you can buy online now. Now, my name's Ian Martin, and today I'm joined by regular guest and equipment expert, Al Morgan. Hi, Al. How are you?
I am absolutely brilliant, as I'm sure we might talk about. I've just been skiing, so I am very happy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we often meet online, as we do now via video, but since we recorded last, I'm delighted to say that we've met in real life, because we're both in teen over Christmas, and it was, you know, I said it at the time, but it was really good to see you in person.
Yeah, it's lovely to meet up in the mountains. Yeah, I mean, we didn't get to ski together, which was a shame, but it was lovely just to catch up and have that beer. Family holidays and Christmas are busy times, eh? But how lucky were we with the snow? So good.
For sure. Well, it snowed very heavily just after we got out there. There were a couple of very cold, very snowy days, probably about 80 centimetres to a metre, I would say, fell overall. High winds, though, it was spread, you know, there were obviously pretty deep patches, I found a bit, but some of the slopes were looking a bit thin by the end of that week.
Yeah, you could really see, especially some of the ridge lines were really wind scoured. Obviously the temperature, as we've seen in recent seasons, varied a lot through that week, but you could see the effect that the wind had, which gave some excellent opportunities for skiing on the kinds of kit that we're going to talk about today. But you just had to help if you knew the area and could pick your lines, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we were definitely lucky. And I don't know about you, but the day, I think it was Christmas Eve, the day after the big snowfall, I did leave my group for a little bit just to chew up some fresh powder on my own, which was great. But today we're going to focus on some of the best ski touring equipment options. And ski touring has become more and more popular in recent years. And I think part of that was COVID driven. When all those lifts were closed, there were a lot of people ski touring in the Alpine resorts. I know lots of people who live out there, and, you know, it was really busy on the mountain.
Yeah.
You know, all the local shops out in France sold out ski touring stuff. But I think that was reflected in the UK as well, because we've interviewed Mike Richards before, who skied in Wales, and different people who were skiing in Scotland and getting out there. But also, I think the interest in ski touring is because people are interested in kind of getting away from it all, being closer to nature, getting away from the lifts, and getting more exercise as well. Do you have a view on that trend?
And all of that is absolutely correct. You know, I saw so many people touring in the UK, in England, in Scotland, in Wales, people that I know of that, you know, done seasons out in resort, work in snow sports, and they were just going out of the back of their houses if they could to go touring. Any opportunity, people were doing it. And the beauty for us as skiers in that is that brands saw that this interest was growing. Obviously, you get very, you know, fluctuations. People bought a lot of kit then. So then we saw some new kit coming out, but it's continued, and we're seeing more and more new products, whether that be skis, bindings, poles, whatever. But the fitness is really key. Brands even make touring kit. So when we're talking about touring, we're talking about the ability to walk uphill on a ski. And we can talk about that in a little bit more. But they even sell ones specifically to go on pistes. And resorts even build pistes for people just to skin up for fitness.
For sure. I mean, ski touring is so significant now that most resorts, it's kind of a surprise when I go to a resort. I did look at the piste map in Teen to see what kind of ski touring was an offer. There weren't really many marked ski touring areas. Whereas if you go to some places, for example, if I go to Courchevel, they've got quite a few there, and, you know, Crans-Montana, massive amount of, you know, marked ski touring routes there. However, I think what we'd like to do, or what I'd like to do, you know, in this episode is to kind of cover two areas. I mean, we talk about kit for ski touring and maybe looking at, you know, two setups, a sort of all-rounder type of setup, you know, for probably more people like me who are, you know, resort skiing and ski touring, you know, from time to time during a trip. And then also that real dedicated, lightweight touring setup, which you'd use for hut-to-hut trips, multi-day ski touring. So we're going to lean on your knowledge for that. But in case there's anyone listening who doesn't actually know what ski touring is, Al, do you want to have a go at explaining that for us?
In the most simple terms, it's the ability to go on a tour or an adventure on skis under your own power. So you absolutely you can use lifts to get into the terrain, but your progress through the terrain is on the skis. So skiing down, so they need to be able to ski, but you need to be able to walk uphill. So there has to be an ability to have a walking motion. So generally the front of the boot somehow in the binding is held on the ski and the heel is free so you can walk. And then on the base of the ski, you attach something that we call a skin, because traditionally they were made from seal skin, so that's why we talk of them as skins. And this has a nap on it, so the ski will slide forward but won't slide backwards. You could think of it as a load of needles. Let's say you get a load of porcupine needles, stick them on the base of the ski pointing backwards. It'll slide forward because all the needles are lie flat on the ski, but when it goes to slide back, the needles would dig into the snow and that will give you traction. And these are generally made from nylon and or mohair, and to give you that nap on that slide. So these have a gluing layer, stick to the base of the ski, they can be removable, and they generally have an attachment for the tip, and most of them have an attachment at the tail as well.
Yeah, so you put the skins on your skis, that's what you use to get the grip when you're going uphill. So in that respect, it's pretty straightforward, but you do need to have slightly different, well, you need to have different bindings to be able to get that flexion on your ski boot. Imagine if you're a regular skier, your toe and your heel are both secured. That's not going to work when you're going uphill.
It's hard work, yes, absolutely. So the binding is more important than the boot in having a function to walk, because that is essential if you're going to make any kind of progress, any speedy progress. You can skate along on a regular downhill binding, absolutely, and you can go on the flat. People will do this between lifts, for example. But to go uphill, you need a binding that will enable a walking function. So there are a couple of ways of doing this. The old traditional way was whereby the binding looked like a normal stepping binding, like an alpine binding, and it would have a rail connecting the toe and heel. So it'd be locked down on the ski for skiing, and then to go into touring, you would release the back of these rails, so the whole binding would pivot on pins under the toe piece. You're just a rod under the toe piece, so it could rock up and down via the toe, so the heel would be free for a walking function. But then when was it? Probably, what were we in? God blimey, it might be 60 years ago now. I'd have to look at the date. So the other end is mega light, where we use pins. So the boot has inserts in the toe and heel, and the binding has pins that fit into those inserts. So the pins stick into the toe of the boot. That gives you the walking function and the hold when you are skiing. And then when you are skiing, in the heel piece of the binding, there are two rods projecting forward, two short pins that integrate with a slot in the back of the boot. So you can ski downhill in a regular format, but you can twist the heel piece so the pins aren't engaged in the heel, and then you can walk in it. And that's the super lightweight version, the really efficient touring rather than frames. And then there's the hybrid, which has become a lot more popular.
So basically, pretty much every binding that I've seen for ski touring, if I understand it correctly, has been hybrid. You know, you do get a couple of frame ones. I actually say that I went ski touring with my brother in Morocco, where we skied around Tubkal in the Atlas Range, and he had a frame binding, and we're like ski touring above 3,000 meters, and it is hard work.
Yeah,
really heavy, a lot more weight that he had to shift. But normally, yeah, it's a hybrid binding where you have those pins that clip in at the front. But evidently, you know, you've got more of the binding. It's more like a regular ski binding on the heel. The big advantage of a pure pin binding is that it's lighter, right?
Yeah, so pure pins are light. I mean, for so ski mountaineering, skimo racing, as we call it, then you can get bindings that are less than 100 grams per binding, well under that if you go for the really, really expensive lightweight carbon affairs. But so the way, you know, if you look at the classic hybrid is either a marker king pin, where we have pins at the toe and a step in at the heel. People often will say that skiing about, or something like the Armada Atomic Salomon Shift. That's the same binding, whereby you step in toe and heel, and in tour mode you have a function at the front to reveal some pins and tour. But that's about 900 grams, whereas a regular downhill binding may be two and a half times that weight.
Okay, well, you've already mentioned the weight, and you mentioned skimo as well, which, you know, is very interesting. I remember last time I was out in Courchevel, I guess like a month ago now or something like that, ski-toured up to Celia, and I was overtaken by people the whole time, and I just assumed they must have lighter kit than me. Can't be anything to do with...
Nothing to do with fitness, Ian, no.
fitness. So let's talk about weight. You've referred to it a few times as well. It makes a hugely significant difference, doesn't it? The amount of weight on your feet, let's say.
Yeah, exactly. So there was not to go too deep in it, but there's a research piece, I believe it was for the military, a number of years ago, just looking at efficiencies, essentially. And one of the outcomes of that research piece was that for every kilo of weight on your feet, it's the same as carrying 5 kilos on your back in terms of energy expenditure. And this was more about trekking, walking, carrying kit, but the same applies for touring. So if I give you an example, if you get a regular 95 mil, so that waist underfoot, 95 mil free ride ski. So that's, you know, even the light ones are maybe around 1,600 grams or more. So let's say 1,650 grams in a 175. If you get an equivalent touring ski, that's two to 400 grams lighter per ski. So we'll just average that, 300 grams per ski lighter, yeah, for 95 mil. And then if you go for the binding, then a free ride binding may be a kilo or more. If you got, say, let's say a king pin, this hybrid, where you got toe pins at the toe and a regular step in at the back, then that's about 300 grams lighter. So we're already 600 grams lighter per foot. And then the boot, which is very, very heavy. So a regular free ride boot may be around 2 kilos in a standard 26 size. But an equivalent like this blue boot behind me, a Scarpa Quattro XT, so that's about 500 grams lighter. So when you add that up per foot, that's the equivalent of 14 kilos saved off your back. That is, imagine carrying an extra 14 kilos of water uphill all the time. It would be exhausting. That's how efficient it is by just saving those little bits of weight off your feet.
Yeah, well, evidently, the weight can make a huge amount of difference. And not only is it going to make a difference, the amount of effort you put in, I guess you're thinking about if you're going to be burning off all those extra calories, and you probably need to be, you know, carrying a bunch of them with you as well. There's some things that can be worth saving. Like if you're doing the oat route, for example, then that's a lot of days of where a lot of your time is going uphill, and therefore having less weight is going to be more advantageous. But just to clarify, there are certain bits of kit that you can't compromise on and that you must be taking with you.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're going to go skiing off-piste, I mean, the essential three would come to mind. You know, you need to carry a shovel, transceiver and probe, and you need a backpack to take those in. And again, like ski kit, you can go lighter on a backpack and go lighter on a shovel, all of these, but you need them to satisfy a certain function. So going so light, and I've done this with kit, I had a really lightweight shovel, and in digging some snow pits just in training for crevasse rescue and things, I end up just snapping the blade of the shovel. And we used to have a lot of plastic blade shovels made of Lexan plastic, which is very strong, but they've just gone because people just found that they fractured and broke. So you need them to satisfy a function, but there are some things you cannot get away without. You have to have that essential three.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, let's have a closer look at equipment. I mean, you referred when you were doing the calculations there, which I will put into the show notes so people can understand, because there are a lot of numbers, you know, flying around there. But we'll look at some of those things in more detail. I mean, you mentioned the widths of the skis. And these days, you know, there are some really modern light touring skis. So let's can we look a bit more in a bit more detail at the type of touring skis that might be available?
Yeah, so I think it's like you mentioned, you know, there's this kind of super light, very efficient hut tour, and then there's that kind of what I would term free ride touring. So somebody may be skiing on piste, just general skiing about resort with friends or whatever, but wants to go and tour. So there tends to be those two camps. Yes, that there's various others, but if you're going to go super light hut, you'll generally go somewhere between 85 to 95 millimeters underfoot. So I often ski on something that's at, say, an 88 to 95 mil. And actually, once you go much wider, so 100 mil or more, there's loads of people that I've spoken with that get real issues with their knees when they're touring. When you're on a pin bind, there's a lot of force going through the front of the boot, a lot of torque force. And if the ski is too wide on certain snow types and when traversing, you get too much pressure down through each side of the knee where the ski's trying to sit flat and you don't want it to. So going too wide is actually inefficient. It's okay for free ride when you're just going uphill, not traversing so much, and just doing short tours. But for hut to hut, I really wouldn't be going any wider than 95 mil underfoot.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's I can completely get that. So tempting as it might be, if you're going to be accessing some really nice powder, you know, going you know wider underfoot isn't going to necessarily going to be the most beneficial side of things. Like you mentioned before about you know Eskimo, ski mountaineering racing, which is going to be in the Olympics, the next Olympics, Milan Cortina, coming up in around this time next year. I mean, they really are looking at speed, aren't they? So for them, the skis are going to be completely different.
Yeah, so Eskimo ski is around 65, 68, maybe 70 mil underfoot. So really like a downhill race, you know, like a regular alpine race ski, really narrow underfoot, but may only be 160 centimeters long. And the ski itself will weigh less than a kilo.
That's pretty
They are really
amazing.
light, and they're amazing. They are not great to ski on. And you
They're
watch
about going
Eskimo
uphill.
races. Yeah,
They don't
watch
have to
Eskimo
ski
races
down,
come
right?
downhill. It's a total battle and it is hilarious and it's brilliant. But these guys have amazing skill. But also remember, the boots that they are in are exceptionally light. There's a boot that I use a lot for touring that is really, really light. It's about a kilo. And I love it, but it took some time to get used to. If you're used to a regular downhill boot, you need to get a boot with support. Do not go for a super light touring boot. You will find it so difficult and exhausting to ski in. It takes time to get used to. And that's why most people will go for something that has a bit more support. But Eskimo stuff, you think ski binding and boot is going to weigh less than 2 kilos?
Well, okay, let's talk about, you know, the specific skis that you like and you would recommend for people who are just looking for an all-rounder setup and then also a lightweight setup as well.
Yeah, so that all-rounder look at a free ride ski. The main thing that you need to consider is that the ski is flat mount. By that, it means that the ski does not have a rail fixed on top that the binding slides onto. If you look at most piste skis, most all-mountain skis, they have that rail system. Ski needs to be able to have holes drilled in it, and then the touring binding, whether that's pins, whether that's hybrid, whether it's rails, gets screwed into the top of the ski. So it must accept that. And then you can kind of pick your free ride ski. So a classic, I've used an old version of this ski for a long time, but the current breed, so Salomon make a range called QST, and that 98 width for men and for women is absolutely brilliant. It gives fantastic behavior on piste, off piste, makes skiing off piste in variable soft snow, things that people often find challenging, far easier. It is light enough to put a hybrid binding on it. So the classic would be something like a Kingpin, but really people are putting shift bindings on this ski nowadays. You carry skins in your pack. And then you go, oh, I want to go and ski that fresh line. Nobody's got to it. 15 minutes skinning, you've got there, and you can just lap it. Brilliant. Such a good setup going that way for regular skiing. And the beauty with the shift binding, and Mark could do a version called the Duke PT, which is a little bit heavier. But with the shift binding or the Duke PT, you can just ski about as normal on a grip walk binding, on a grip walk boot, sorry, on a regular downhill boot and a touring norm boot. They'll all work in those bindings.
And how much do those skis retail for?
Good question. I think it's 550 for that ski. So,
Is that the flat ski. Like,
that's naked, as we would call it. Yes, that's without the binding. So you are looking at 400 plus pounds for the binding on top of that as well, depending on which binding you go for. Bindings are one of the most expensive bits of ski kit to develop. And that is why there's a cost. If you have a touring function, there's a lot more going on. And actually, when we look at boots, so we've spoken a bit about pins in the toe and heel. In a boot that has a pin into it at the toe and heel, that is about the most expensive part to manufacture for that boot. So touring kit can have a cost.
Yeah, well, we'll come back. We'll come on to boots in due course. But that was your choice there, the Salomon QST 98 as a free ride ski.
Men's and women's, yeah. It's brilliant.
Yeah. And what about for longer tours where, you know, we talked about the weight, where weight is much more important? What are you thinking of there?
Yeah, and here you're looking at something 88 to 95 mil underfoot. And actually, I've done a load of skiing on 88 mil skis. So a classic, and the reason why I'm picking this ski, it changed last season. This width didn't exist. So Atomic make a backland range of touring skis. They're about the biggest for a regular downhill ski brand. They have about the biggest touring range of products. And the Backland 88, which they came up last year, they changed the profile. One of the things they found with people were, during the pandemic, like you mentioned, people were coming from regular downhill skis into touring skis, and they feel so washy through the front. You can't engage the front of the ski. You have to ski them in quite a different way. They wanted a ski that regular downhill skiers could get on and ski it in a normal way, yet it was super light for going uphill. And the Backland 88 is brilliant. And what is fantastic is they reduced the carbon footprint of this product by around 30%. So they made an 85, 88, 95. So that's how they could tell how much carbon they were reducing. But it skied so much better than the old 85, the old 95. All three of those widths were just sensational. But that 88 is a real sweet spot if you're going to go for multi-day tours. Put a pure pin binding on that and you will be off like a whippet.
Okay, and I've got to ask you again, what are the costs for that and what kind of binding would you be putting on it?
Yeah, so really you're going to put a pin binding on it. Pin binding prices, I mean, vary. You're looking, again, in the region of something like a Shift, you know, £300-£500, depending on the binding. The cost of the 88 is around £500.
Okay, so I mean, it's a setup. It's going to be similar kind of price as the others. Just to clarify in relation to that hybrid versus pin binding, they offer the same amount of security for keeping your foot in the binding. There's got to be some kind of difference in.
They do it in different ways. So many people feel a bit nervous on a pin binding because you have these little pins at the toe. And then at the back, the pins are only in the center of the heel. So people feel nervous of it. They want to feel more secure. And that's why the hybrid binding exists. There is a huge amount of debate about which is safer, whether you get sideways release at the heel or at the toe. I've done a lot of skiing in pure pins. And you look at, there's some amazing skiers that will go and send it off massive cliffs on pure pins. And these guys are going really hard. So these bindings are secure, are safe. And the modern, there's even pin bindings that have more support under the heels to get even more drive through the ski. So don't worry about that so much. The beauty in a hybrid, especially when you look at a Duke PT or a Shift, is that you can use it in ski mode with boots that don't have pin insets. If you use a kingpin or you use something else, it has to have pin insets.
Okay, well, that's really interesting. So we've got the Salomon QSD 98 and the Atomic Backland 88 as your two suggestions there. Now, we're not going to go into any detail about split boards. I know there are lots of snowboarders who listen to the ski podcast. I will refer you to the Snowboard Asylum rather than Ellis Brigham, because that's Ellis Brigham's specialist snowboard shop. But I thought it might be just useful to explain for people who perhaps, you know, don't have any idea that snowboarders can go touring as well. And that is using something called split boards. Al, do you want to just explain what they are and how they
work? Yeah. So you'd look at it and you'd be forgiven for thinking it's a regular snowboard. If you look at it with the bindings on it, somebody's riding, you might not guess. But actually the board has notice a line down the middle. So it splits, hence split board. And you can then, that has fixings on it, so you can change the bindings so they're facing forward like a ski binding, and it allows that walking motion, so the heel is free. So they can put skins on the bottom ascend, and then attach the snowboard back together as one complete board, change the bindings into regular snowboard position, and ride back down.
Oh, okay. Well, that's great. So thinking about ski touring again, then, let's move on to boots. I mean, you referred to boots a few times already, and you mentioned before about the cost involved in actually getting those inserts for the pins at the front of the binding into a ski boot. It's quite a complicated business, and it puts up the cost of the boots.
It's the cost of manufacturing the metal part. It's the same way that Ferrari makes their engines.
Right. Okay. So technically very difficult, but let's look at it again from our kind of two areas that we're approaching it. We've kind of got the free ride touring. There's quite a lot of boots like that. You know, I have an Atomic Prime Extend 130, I think, which has those, pin options at the front. But what would you pick then from that free riding point of view? What are your thoughts there?
Yeah. So, this is when people talk of all mountain skis, they want a ski that'll do everything. And this kind of boot is your do everything boot. So it skis downhill very, very close to a regular downhill boot. Whatever the brands tell you, it is not the same as a downhill boot. If you test a lot of boots, you can notice the difference. But for a lot of people, that compromise, because it's such a small compromise, is certainly worth it. So it gives you the function to walk. So if you're going to go and hike up for fresh lines, you can do that. You release a lever generally at the back of the boot, so you get more movement in the cuff. So we call this range of movement. And then that locks back in for ski mode, but they are heavier. So a classic would be a K2 Mind Bender. And boa closures that we see on the bottom bit of the boot, so K2 Mind Bender boa for men and for women. This is a brilliant free ride boot. So it allows you to go touring and that you can ski really, really hard. The women's 105 boa is, it looks damn cool. It's a fantastic looking boot. But K2 have done so much work on their boots and their liners. The current iteration is really, really good. You've got toe inserts front and back. But as I mentioned, the cost is higher. So it's £625 for this boot. But it means that you've got something you can use on piste, off piste, whatever you're doing, regular grip, walk, sole. It's pretty cool.
Oh, excellent. I actually had some, not related to the boots, but K2 Mindbender skis from Intersport in Teen Lalac, and they were great for the
had. Absolutely. But again, like that QST, that upper 90s width on those Mindbenders are absolutely sensational. And again, it's flat mount. You can put a free ride touring binding on that and off you go, as long as you've got some skins.
Oh, okay. So we're saying K2 Mindbender, men and women, is a recommendation for free ride touring boots. What about if you want to go lighter?
Yeah. So there are some specific tour brands, but main brands, you know, K2 do Dispatch LT, Atomic has their Backland range of lightweight boots. So something that really changed with them was they came up with a Backland Extend, which has an amazing tour function. But here I'm looking specifically at Scarpa. So Scarpa is known for their touring product. They actually make one of the best free ride boots on the market. If you look over my shoulder, you can see a blue boot, Scarpa Quattro XT.
I was going to say, why don't you bring it forward? Let's have a closer look at
that. 1 second. Sorry, I'm back. So Scarpa Quattro XT. Scarpa made a different boot called the Freedom, which wasn't that great, but the Quattro XT is brilliant. However, this isn't the boot that I'm going to talk about. This is quoted as 1,500 grams. My pair weigh 1,440. Actually, they're lighter. I know so many professionals that use that boot, but they make a lighter weight version called the Mistrali and the Gia for women, Mistrali for men, but the RS version in particular. So this is a lot lighter. It's around 1,300 grams, but the skiing function out of it is absolutely brilliant. So I do a lot of testing with a free ride athlete and ski coach called Fionn Townsend. She was testing the women's, the Gia, and I was testing the men's. But both of them are, the skiing out of them for how well they tour is absolutely superb, but it is light enough for hot tours, for multi-day adventures. It's brilliant. They do a lightweight version. For me as a skier, I always go for the RS.
So you mentioned that that's 1,300 grams, and we were talking about weight. Just to put that in context then, how does that compare to the weight of the Mindbender?
Yeah, so the Mindbender is just over 350 grams heavier. So it's not massive, much lighter than a regular Alpine boot, or markedly lighter, but skis like a regular Alpine.
Yeah, and what about price? How does the Scarpa come in?
Yeah, so that the Gears, as I mentioned, touring kit is quite pricey, £670. Yes, you can pay a lot more for touring boots, but yeah, that's the price you have to pay. But I love it. The new version, I much prefer to the old boot. You've got over 60 degrees, so 61 degrees, as I refer to range of motion in the cuff. So this means that the cuff can lean backwards, forwards, so you get a longer, more efficient stride.
Yeah, I mean, that is important as well. And I think probably it's worth mentioning that the lighter boots, the more specific ski touring boots, are also, would I be right in saying that they're maybe a bit more flexible? You know, while the hybrid boots are designed for, you know, being able to ski tour in, maybe it might be worth taking a few Compeed or plasters along with you just in case.
The main thing there, this is a massively valid point. When you are downhill skiing, your boot is held, holds your foot and ankle in a pretty fixed position. Yes, you flex at the ankle and it goes forward and backwards a little bit, but not a huge amount. When you are touring, your foot, ankle, heel, all through the Achilles moves in the boot a lot. If you are going to go and hike 20 miles in a walking boot, you will get that boot fitted by a good shop. You will break it in so it's molded around your feet, and you would not go out and hike for 20 miles in a boot when you've just gone and bought it and not even tried it. Same for touring, especially for touring. You've got a hard plastic shell. Get the boots fitted. This is really important, so that they are fitted for you for touring, not just for skiing, so that you have room in those specific areas around the ankle, around the heel, places of rub. Your professional boot fitter can ensure that you're not going to get those problems. Yes, you can take Compeed with you, etc., but get the boot fitted. So much.
Cool. Okay. I don't think we'll go into bindings because we have discussed that, and you've mentioned a few models along the way and how we looked at that. So the key elements, if you're touring, clearly the skis and the boots. I think we probably think of, you know, clothing, jackets in a slightly different way, because we're much more interested in layers overall, because evidently when you're going up, you can get a lot hotter than when you're, you know, skiing along and skiing down.
Yeah, this is really, really important. If people refer back to our jackets episode, you know, we talk about insulated pieces, we talk about shell pieces. Touring is the domain of shell. You are not going to go in a really thick insulated jacket and skin uphill. You will get so hot, so sweaty, you'll be so inefficient. But the massive benefit in using a shell and insulating layers underneath, so you need a good wicking base layer against your skin to get that moisture off you, so that when you stop, you don't get a chill, so that you can just be really efficient in cooling. You then have one or more insulating layers, whether that's a fleece, whether that's synthetic insulating layers, and then you have the shell on top. And a lot of the time when you're touring, you will not have the shell. You will not be wearing it over your insulating pieces, even when you're skiing, because you're still generating quite a bit of heat. It may just be in your pack. And this is why for touring, especially when you're doing multi-day tours, weight, again, you are looking at lighter weight kit. So I have a Patagonia Stormstride outfit that I use from almost all my touring. It's mega, mega light. It's really thin. I wouldn't go and use it if I was going to go scrambling around rocky outcrops, doing bits of free ride, things when things are going to get abused a lot, because it is much lighter. For free ride touring, you're still going to have shells, but they may just be a bit baggier because it has that look. Skin tight isn't really the look for free ride, but people just have it because they're going to use it for resort skiing, all this kind of thing, so it'll be a bit heavier. But that shell is really, really important. And then the other thing that you can do, you can get something called soft shell. When we talk about shell, it's mainly hard shells. It's waterproof, breathable, keeps all the weather out. Soft shell isn't fully taped, isn't fully waterproof like that. It may have a membrane in it, whether it's Gore Infinium or whatever. So there are mountain sport brands, Montane, for example, and lots of others that make soft shell products for touring. And some of these brands are bringing out touring kit. Rab, we saw a few seasons ago, start to come out with Chroma kit for skiing. So mega light, mega breathable.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you mentioned Montane. I've been using that brand for trail running for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, when I did my research for the UTMB, a lot of it led me towards Montagne. So I bought that as my compulsory windproof, waterproof jacket, but lightweight,
yeah.
Which similar type of thing. I mean, that's a long run. So the weight was important. But this year they brought out a range of ski clothing for the first time. So my wife has got one of their layers. I'm not sure she's done any ski touring yet, but maybe she will down the track.
But your running piece there, you know, that's a great example of something. Don't go out and buy a full new setup for touring. Look at that, especially if you're into mountain sports, if you're into climbing, walking, there will be kit that you use. So there's a down jacket that I've got for just winter sports in general by Rabba Mythic G, but it's super, super light, super light. Exceptionally warm, and I keep that in my backpack when I'm touring. And the number of times that I've had to stop to either assist somebody with kit or we're doing something else, whether we're doing, like I mentioned before, you're doing crevasse rescue training, and I shove that on over the top of everything, over the top of my shell to keep warm. So you need that extra bit of kit, but it needs to be light packable in your pack. And my word, is it a bit of a savior.
Yeah, and being able to pack stuff small is important as well. Sorry, what you just mentioned then was the Rab?
Just the Rab Mythic G. Yeah, yeah, right. Exactly. So it's about £400 off the top of my head, but super light. It is down. I wouldn't ski in a down jacket. I get very hot when I'm ski touring, and the moisture from my body can affect down. So I use synthetic insulated, or actually a lot of the time I've got a merino wool insulated mid layer, but when you stop, when I'm not producing that moisture, but the cold is a factor, shoving on a down jacket is very, very hard to beat.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that is one of the factors. I mean, sometimes a lot of ski touring might go on towards the end of the season when temperatures are a bit warmer, but regardless, given that you finish at altitude and you've been sweating, I think it's very important not to stand around too long with that sweat, letting it evaporate and get those extra layers on quickly. Okay, let's just touch on, you know, we could probably do, with your knowledge, a whole episode on this, but what about poles? The type of poles that you'd be taking if you're going ski touring, would they be different from your regular skiing?
There are specific ski touring poles. So some of these will be collapsible, but one of the main design features that you will see on a touring pole, I've got one beside me, I'm going to grab it. So they can be telescopic and collapsible. This is a Leki pole, a Sherpa carbon, which I use a lot, mainly because it's really light, really stiff. And for me, I'm often filming when I'm skiing, so I can put this in a backpack. You do not need a collapsible pole for ski touring unless you're going to be doing climbing in there. But it's this. There's a regular grip. So if you're watching on video, you can see at the top. But for those just listening, there's a regular grip at the top, but it has a longer foam section running down the shaft of the pole under the handle. And the reason for this is when you're going sideways around a hill, so you're traversing, the uphill hand needs a much shorter pole than the downhill hand. So then to keep your hands at a similar level, you can slide your hand down the pole and you've still got something to grip. You do not have to have this on a pole for touring. A lot of my time spent touring is with a regular ski pole. Because when I'm skiing, people go, oh, but your hands can stick to the pole, it's metal. If it's that cold that my hand's going to stick to the shaft of the pole, I will, you can bet, have a pair of gloves on. So that is a moot point as far as I'm concerned. A pole gives you traction for pushing along. The beauty in an extendable version like that is that when you're doing long, long traverses or flats, you can make the pole a bit longer. So like a regular cross-country ski poles are quite long. That grip on the shaft can be quite good, but it does not have to be adjustable. You do not have a grip. You can do it on a regular pole, but it must have a bigger basket because you are in powder snow.
And I think also these days, if you're doing what I do, which is more typically getting some touring skis from a hire shop just for a day or so, although I can tell you, Al, in advance that for next winter, I'm planning to buy my first pair of skis for decades, and I want to get a touring setup. So it'll be really interesting to see what I end up with. But regardless of that, most hire shops these days, they don't have poles or fixed lengths. They have adjustable poles because it's a lot easier for them to hold those in stock.
Yeah.
And, you know, you do have a different difference in length typically from when you're ascending to when you're descending. So, you know, having something adjustable is important. And you mentioned gloves there. Again, when I'm touring, I've got my regular ski gloves, but if I'm ascending, they're going to be in my backpack. You know, I'll have some thinner gloves depending on what the temperature is. So worth taking those with you as well. In terms of helmets, I think back in the helmets episode, we mentioned the there are some kind of touring or backcountry specific helmets. Yeah. One of them we mentioned was the Oakley Mod BC. Well, I've got one of those now, and I found it so comfortable. I love the you know, the setting at the back, the BOA setting. I wasn't wearing a helmet for most of my skiing for years, and now my family are much happier. But that's more of a lightweight one. I think if you're taking a helmet, you need to consider, you're probably not going to wear it when you're going up, but you need to consider how you're going to secure it to your backpack, how you're going to secure it when you're going up. And that's a key factor as well to think about, isn't it?
Yeah, so the beauty with, you know, not just the fixate on that helmet, but the thing that I love about that Mod BC is it goes really slim against the back of the backpack. And, you know, there are other, Jolbo makes some excellent helmets like this. Lots of brands make specific helmets. You know, they're touring brands, Genafit, that make a really good helmet like that. But one of the things you notice of these helmets is that they are certified for skiing and for mountaineering, because what you're doing when you're ski touring is you're in that high mountain environment where there could be some sort of rock fall, or you just want other protection that isn't catered for in the skiing norm. So you will find that they will be certified at least for skiing and mountaineering, and some are also certified for cycling.
Okay, cool. Well, I mean, we could cover all of those areas, including backpacks, in a lot more detail as well. But this will be a very long podcast.
Yeah.
So we're not going to go into those. What I am going to do is I'm actually going to drop in an interview I did a little while ago. I came across a product called a Zawa, which is a portable backcountry lift. So let's have a listen to that. Right, I'm delighted to be joined today by Rob Button, who is the founder of Zawa Engineering. How are you, Rob?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Excellent. I wanted to ask you on today because I recently came across one of your products. It's pretty amazing. It's the Zawa PL1. And basically, well, I guess I'm right in saying it's a portable rope tow you can take into the backcountry. And we're going to discuss a little bit more about how it works. But what prompted you to create this particular invention?
Well, for me, it was just kind of a desire to get more out of the day when I go backcountry skiing. And I kind of looked at a number of different types of concepts. But this was kind of where I ended up. I think that ultimately I had done a bit of work on with kind of brushless motors and lithium ion batteries. And I kind of figured out that there's quite a bit of power density there and that this was a feasible thing. And I kind of jumped into it from there.
You invented the product. I mentioned it earlier. It's a portable rope tow for the backcountry. And the unit itself is something that you can put into your backpack. You ski tour up, and then do you want to explain what happens from that point onwards?
Yeah, so you're going to tour up the way you kind of normally would, and when you get to the top of, you know, the slope you want to ski, what we usually do is we usually put in an anchor. You can potentially tie it to a tree, but we have a snow anchor that we sell with a basic package, and you can kind of just put a T-slot in the snow and bury that in there, and that'll hold a whole lot of weight. And then you kind of, we have the rope is attached to that anchor. You know, we provide our sort of basic package with 1,000 feet. You can bring multiple lengths if you want, but you're going to have that in a rope bag, and you're going to ski down the first time laying out the rope as you go down.
And you said 300 meters, but you said 1,000 feet. That's about 300 meters for metric listeners. How much does the unit weigh?
So 10.5 pounds, or about 4.8 kilos is that's sort of the drive unit. And then the rope is, another 4.5 pounds, or I think that's like about 2 kilos or so.
Yeah. Oh, okay. But the payoff is that once you've laid it out the first time, you ski tool up and then laid that rope down, then basically you can ski down and get a lift back up anytime you want to.
Yeah, exactly. And you leave the rope loose at the bottom. So the device just grips on anywhere along that rope and pulls you up.
Yeah, I'm going to put a link into the show notes so people can see what I'm talking about. It's an electric battery. What's the kind of lifespan of it? How many rotations is it going to get you?
So we do have like, we have a chart on our website that gives you an idea based on the main factor is like how heavy you are. So we do have a chart on the website that gives you, but like as a rough number, I usually say about 800 meters of vertical is what you can expect. So the number of laps will vary depending on the slope you're on.
That sounds great. And so to me, it sounds like something would be really useful if you've got like a hill near you with no lifts at all, or maybe the lifts haven't opened for the season. There's been a great early season snowfall or something like that. How much does the ZOA PO1 cost then? What are we looking at?
In the US right now, it's about $1,700 US. We aren't currently selling it in the UK yet, but we're hoping that we'll be doing that soon. Hopefully for next season, that will be for sale in Europe and the UK. But yeah, so about $1,700 US is what the basic package, and that includes everything you need, includes the rope, the anchor, and the device and the charger for it.
Oh, well, it sounds like a brilliant invention. And again, to reiterate, I'm going to put a link in the show notes. And I think if people go to the website, which is zoaeng.com, they'll get a much better idea of what it's about. Really, I would like to congratulate you, Rob. Brilliant idea. It's great to see things like this coming to the market. And thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
So, I mean, that's kind of, interesting. I think you need to have it in the right circumstances. Al, have you come across the ZOA before?
I've not used it. I have come across it. And you know, these things are fantastic. Small anecdote, when I was a wee kid, a lot younger than I am now, a friend's dad owned a lawnmower shop, and they built a ski tow out of a small lawnmower engine, and you just run a rope down the hill, and the kids could get pulled back up the hill on it. And that's essentially what this does. This is a modern day version of that. You can fix the motor unit at the top of the hill and then get pulled up by a cord. I'm lucky enough to get to do a lot of touring. The amount of time to set that up, and am I going to lap the same piece? Possibly not. There is a huge weight and there is a massive cost. But I love anything like this that's allowing people to get out, ski more and enjoy the backcountry. And especially something like this that isn't polluting in that environment is pretty cool.
Yeah, excellent. Well, I'm going to put a link into the show notes for that as well. Now, in all of our episodes, we've asked some of Ellis Brigham's employees to give us their tips. For this episode on ski touring, I asked Matt Brown, who works up in Aviemore, what his recommendations would be for someone wanting to get into ski touring for the first time.
Hey, Ian. Thanks for having me on the show. I've been living and working within the Cairngorms National Park for the last 5.5 years, with the last 2 years working at Ellis Brigham Aviemore in the ski department. Through winter, my main focus is ski touring, which sees me getting out in all kinds of conditions, experiencing some epic bluebird days skiing gullies, and some character building days in the white room. For folk who are just getting into ski touring and are looking to invest in some kit, I have a few pieces of advice that would help them along the way. First up, I highly recommend purchasing a pair of ski boots that fit you, are comfortable, and meet your needs. You can visit your local Ellis Brigham for a boot fit with one of our boot fitters who will do their best to find the best ski boot for you. Everyone knows that uncomfortable footwear leads to negative experiences, so it's best to make sure that your feet are happy. Next up would be to get avalanche safety gear, consisting of a transceiver, shovel, and a probe. Just having these pieces of kit doesn't automatically make you safer, and so going on an avalanche course will benefit you greatly, helping you to understand the snow in the backcountry, even in Scotland, where the weather is often very changeable and the snowpack is always changing. Locally in Aviemore, you can book courses with Glenmore Lodge, the National Training Centre, or alternatively with British Backcountry, run by Blair Aitken and Gavin Carruthers. You can also book on for skills courses and guiding in the backcountry. Coming to skis and bindings, it's best to understand what you're trying to get out of for ski touring. Are you looking to travel through the mountains and explore new areas? Or are you seeking out backcountry lines to ski hard and fast? You could go down the line of pin bindings for simple and lightweight use, or perhaps something such as frame bindings or the likes of the shift binding is what would suit you best. Also, make sure that your bindings are compatible with your boots. Skis, I think, are based on skiing experience and the terrain of choice. For example, I have a couple of setups. I have skinny skis with lightweight pin bindings for journey days, but then I also have wider skis with burlier bindings for when I want to ski harder and if there's deeper snow. You could also hire a variety of skis to help you give more of an understanding of how different skis and bindings work. In our Avonmore store, we have a wide range of skis to hire. Head into your local LS Brigham for a chat with our experts, and we'll be more than happy to help you along your journey into the mountains. Cheers.
So that was really interesting to talk to Matt. Al, I know you know him well. He mentioned the Glenmore Lodge, which you often mention. He also mentioned Blair Atkin. And listeners, if you haven't heard my episode in Scotland, I think it was about 202. I'll put a link into the show notes. Had an amazing day with Blair on Ben Laws. But what do you think of what Matt had to say, Al?
100% with him. You know, Blair Atkin, Gav Crothers, I do bits of work with those guys. I do a lot with, up at Glenmore Lodge. I go up there every winter. I love it. But yeah, get educated. It's a bit like the transceiver, shovel and probe. There is no point having those things unless you know how to use it and practice using it. When somebody has a problem and you need to go and find them, that is not the time to learn. And it's the same for all of those backcountry skills. You are going into an environment where you are fully responsible for your safety and those around you. Get educated. Go and do a course. Go to Glenmore Lodge and go and do a mountain skills course. Go and do a touring course. Come on the Wild Ski Weekend. Come up there. I'll be up there in March anyway. It's so good. Go and have a go on this kit. You know, I absolutely adore ski touring, whether I'm going out for 10 minutes to get a fresh line, whether I'm going out for 4 hours for, you know, to get away from everybody. It is so addicting. It is a beautiful thing to do. But everything needs a bit of time to learn.
Yeah, excellent. I actually got a copy of the Scottish Ski Club journal for 2024, and I noticed a full page ad in there for the World Ski Weekend.
Yeah,
so I'll put a link to that in the show notes.
The front, that, I know exactly where that line is. So the guy in the front, Sandy Townsend, who's head of skiing at Glenmore Lodge, and the Fionn that I mentioned before, that this amazing ski is his daughter. But I was there on that photo shoot as well, actually. That's funny.
Excellent. Al's referring to the photo in the advert, which you can see if you look at the video. Right. We're going to move on towards the end now. Now, you know, I love all feedback about the show. I really like to know what you think as a listener, especially about the features. So you can contact me at the Ski Podcast on social, or email theskipodcast@gmail.com. Now, the last regular episode I published was an interview with John Yates Smith. And some people probably wouldn't have heard of him. And I was interested to know how it would go down, because he was so interesting and amusing to interview.
He's very funny.
But maybe not a lot of people would have. And I've just had some amazing feedback about it. So I'm just going to read a couple of them out. Paul Bond said, of all the topics that could be on the podcast, the choice of pellets for a shotgun wasn't one I had on my bingo card. David Bell said, Ian, I enjoyed your interview with John so much. What a great character and what a great life story to tell with a refreshingly honest outlook. I was laughing along with you. Please have him on again. Anthony Benson said, John, you're a legend. You taught me a lot about life working for you when I was 19 in Val d'Isère and Corsica, also working for your brother, Dick. They're the best years of my life. And I remember the time the Corsicans tried to burn the Vlinko down. Quinn R said, absolutely loved the podcast with John Yates Smith. So listener, if you haven't listened to that episode, hopefully that's whetted your appetite. He is a very entertaining guy. Yeah. Who's, you know, currently in his 50th season in Val d'Isère. Back to the equipment specials. David Lindsay said, I've only just listened to the Ski Boot special. What an excellent podcast. Al knows his stuff. Colin, I don't know if I've warned you of this question, Al, but he said, do you have any recommendations for earbuds to wear with helmets?
Right. Okay. I've got a question for you on this, Ian, actually, because yeah, I've seen this in some notes, and this is a really relevant question, especially. So there's a system called Carve, which you can attach to your boots, and it really helps you develop. And I know you've used it. I've used it. What do you use to listen to the Carve announcements when you're skiing? What do you use? Do you use a regular earbud?
No, I just have it in my pocket with the volume on.
Right. Okay.
So after yeah. I've stopped, I listen to, you know, what it says my ski IQ was and whatever tips. You know, I don't listen to it on the lifts and kind of, you know, bother other people.
Okay,
those people who ski around with Bluetooth speakers on it and things like that. Go on.
But yeah, no, in testing it, so I did exactly like Colin saying, I use earbuds. But actually, I didn't find them that comfortable. And sometimes they dislodge when you're bumpy terrain, etc. But most helmets can accept an audio system. So the one that I've used quite a lot, there's a brand called Alec, and they make something called nunchucks. So they sit inside the ear pads of your helmet, and then the connecting cable between the two pods runs in the pad at the back. And most, many helmets will accept this kind of audio system. And I much prefer that over having just the normal in-your-ear buds. But the other beauty is that you can kind of do touch to talk. So you can call, you know, you've got hands-free system. So, and you just got better, I find I have better audio awareness than having something shoved in my ear.
Well, that's probably answered the question for Colin, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. Great. So if you like the podcast, listener, there are a few things you can do to help us. You can review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and that helps other listeners find us. You can subscribe so you never miss an episode. Just press that follow or subscribe button now. Or you can buy me a coffee if you want at buymeacoffee.com/theskipodcast. Now we now have 243 episodes to catch up with, and a whopping 209 of those listened to in the last week. There is so much to listen to in our back catalogue. Just go to theskipodcast.com, search around the tags and categories, and you're bound to find something of interest to you there. But if you haven't listened to the John Yates Smith episode, listen to that one first. You can follow me at Skipedia and the podcast at Ski Podcast. But for now, I would like to thank Ellis Brigham for sponsoring the show and for letting us bring you these episodes, because, you know, I've really enjoyed them. Hopefully you've enjoyed them. We've enjoyed putting them together. And I really want to thank Al for sharing his incredible knowledge with us. I found it, you know, really educational, and I hope you have too. So thanks very much, Al.
Thank you, Ian.
We will be back with all the info you need about the new kit for the following winter season in the autumn. But before then, listeners can look forward to episode 232. That's coming up in a week's time, when we will be discussing skiing in Bosnia, teen and gay ski week. So until then, listener, thank you for joining us. Until next time, goodbye.